This is Lecture 10 of the lecture cycle by Rudolf Steiner entitled Initiate Consciousness. Lecture 10 is entitled Influences of the Extra-Terrestrial Cosmos on Human Consciousness. I indicated yesterday how the abnormal ways into the spiritual world, those appearing in conditions of disease, on the one hand, the way of inner mystical deepening, of being carried to greater depths in the dream world, and on the other hand, the way that traverses, rather, I might say, in a caricature of the natural scientific method, the phenomena afforded externally in connection with the somnambulist and medium. I indicated how both these ways must be grasped and must be extended further in a fruitful manner if actual initiation knowledge is to come about. We shall now penetrate further into this realm if we form a conception of the influences from the side of the cosmos to which human consciousness is subjected, and together with human consciousness the entire being of man in general. You can easily see that among the causes operating upon the human being, apart from those that are earthly, the effect derived from the sun and the moon exceed all others. People do not ordinarily think about the matter, but it is entirely obvious today, even on the basis of natural science, that nothing would exist upon the earth but for the influences of the sun, which descend upon the earth from the extraterrestrial cosmos. The influences of the sun conjure forth the entire plant nature. The influences of the sun are necessary for everything animal, but also for everything in man that is physical and etheric. The influence of the sun can be observed wherever we are willing to observe it, and it is extremely important even for the higher members of man's being. The influence of the moon is not so much observed. It is found today very much in superstition, and what can be known about it, what can be known exactly, is misrepresented because of the very fact that there are so many conceptions regarding the influence of the moon, which do homage to superstitions, and that those who desire today to deal with science feel themselves to be above the level of every superstition, so that they reject even what is significant in the influences of the moon and will not allow this to enter into real science. Here and there, however, are intimations, not only among poets, who know with what stimulation the spell of the moon works upon fantasy, and not only among lovers, who like to pursue their love affairs by moonlight, but even among men of knowledge. There is an intimation that influences from the moon, even though of an entirely different character, are everywhere occurring on the earth. In this matter, it is possible to learn quite noteworthy things. In the middle of the 19th century, there were two learned men in Germany. One was called Schleiden, the other Gustav Theodor Fechner. Gustav Theodor Fechner, taking his departure from an entirely exact standpoint, liked to enter into the more secret workings of nature, both in the human being and also externally in great nature. Especially did he collect data and make up a sort of statistics to show that the amount of rainfall at any given place is related to full moon and new moon, etc. And he discovered on this basis, according to his view, that there is a greater rainfall at any single place in connection with certain phases of the moon than in connection with other phases. He espoused this view. He did not shrink from asserting the claims of this kind of science in the presence of ordinary science. But his colleague in the university, Professor Schleiden, the great botanist, was of a different opinion. He ridiculed this opinion of Fechner's and said that moon influences of such a character were entirely out of the question. But the remarkable thing was this. Both these learned men were married, and in the comparatively small university city, which is nevertheless one of the largest cities of Germany, there still existed patriarchal relationships. It was then customary for the women to collect rainwater because they supposed that this was especially good for laundry purposes. Now, then, there was a Frau Professor Fechner, and there was also a Frau Professor Schleiden. It came about that not only the two professors discussed this question, but also the women joined in the discussion. And lo and behold, Professor Fechner said to his wife, quote, "Now then, Professor Schleiden does not believe that the phases of the moon have any influence upon the volume of rainfall. So you just say that you desire these moon phases for collecting rainwater, and that Frau Professor Schleiden can collect after you in a different phase. Since Professor Schleiden does not believe that the phases of the moon have any influence, there can be no objection to this." And just think, Frau Professor Schleiden was not willing to give up to Frau Professor Fechner those phases of the moon in regard to which her husband did not believe that there would be more rainwater at that time. Thus there came about a nice little university family quarrel over this matter. But it really had a scientific background. And if we examine such influences, but with a more spiritual scientific means, we discover that it is possible to speak, not only in superstition but in real science, of strong influences of the moon, just as of influences of the sun. This, however, exhausts in a certain sense all that enters into the facts embraced by the ordinary consciousness of the present day. The present day man lives, so to speak, under the influences of earth, moon, and sun. The present day man is essentially dependent, even as regards his consciousness, upon the earth, the moon, and the sun. For, as I have already pointed out, what is externally visible in the stars is not indeed the essential. Neither is this true of the externally visible in the sun and the moon. We have expressly spoken of the fact that the moon's sphere is the abode of those beings who once were the great primeval teachers of humanity. Thus the moon's sphere is the abode of a great collection of spiritual beings. Every star is a colony of beings, just as the earth is a cosmic colony of humanity. But as we have said, the human being who is now spending the time between birth and death lives almost exclusively under the influence of earth, sun, and moon. Now the important matter is to learn to understand adequately how man, in his entire conscious and also bodily state, that is to say, in his state of spirit, soul, and body, lives under the influences of sun and moon. Let us take the two extreme states of consciousness, between which lies the dream state. Let us take the waking, daylight state, and the state of consciousness, wholly unconscious, if I may form such a contradiction, the state of sleep, the state of dreamless sleep. When we follow the human being as he exists during sleep, parenthesis, physical body and ether body are separated from astral body and ego, parenthesis, then we find that in what he has drawn out of his physical body and out of his etheric body as the astral body and ego, that in this, during the period between falling asleep and awaking, the human being carefully stores up inwardly the influences of the sun. In the period between waking and sleeping, we look externally on the sun. Even when the sky is completely covered with clouds, we still behold its influence, for what we see of other things is indeed reflected sunbeams. During our entire waking state, we are under the influence of the sun as it illuminates things externally. The moment that we fall asleep and pass into that other state, the sunlight begins to shine, visibly to the spiritual eye, EYE, in our ego and our astral body. There, between falling asleep and awaking, we have sun within us. You know, of course, that there are certain minerals which, when we expose them to light, under certain conditions, and then darken the space where they are, preserve the light and radiate light back into the darkness as an after effect. Thus it is to spiritual observation with the human ego and the human astral body. They are, in a certain sense, exposed to the tones of the external sunlight during the waking state. They begin to glow and shine. Now that they bear the sunlight within them, between falling asleep and waking. We may therefore express the matter thus. While a person is awake, he is under the influence of the external action of the sun. During sleep, he is under the influence of the action of the sun that he now bears within himself, until he wakes. We have sun within us while we sleep, and have left behind us during the night only the physical and the etheric body. But in the spirit we ourselves illuminate from outside, with the stored-up sunlight we now have, our physical and etheric bodies. And if we did not do this, if we did not radiate from without with our stored-up sunlight, our skin and even the interior of the sense organs, the human being would very soon quite dry up, become withered and wilted. Indeed, we do all that is required for the freshness and growth and vitality of our organism by shining upon our skin and upon our senses during sleep by means of our stored-up sunlight. Thus the situation is really such that during sleep, while the human being is outside with his ego and his astral body, he illuminates his skin in the first place by means of sunlight, and also in the second place the sunlight works through eyes and ears, even into the nerves. This is the phenomenon of human sleep, that the sun shines, passing from the human ego and the human astral body outward and entering into the very man himself, irradiating the skin, streaming into the human being, wherever there are doors of the senses. Then, no matter whether it is new moon or full moon, for the influences are only altered thereby, but they are present in all phases of the moon, what happens with respect to the moon influences is that they come in contact with the human being from without and are extended over the physical and ether bodies. Thus we have in the physical and the ether body, during sleep, sun influences from the ego and the astral body, and moon influences upon the physical and ether bodies from without. Observe, then, that this gives to the state of sleep its character in relationship to the cosmos. The human being stands inwardly in relationship to the sun. He stands outwardly in relationship to the moon. For the astral body and the ego are still the inner being, even though they are now outside. In the waking state, this is reversed. When we awake, we bear within us inwardly, quite inwardly, the moon influences, and the sun influences come from without. Thus we may say, when we awake, the sun influences from without come in direct contact with the physical and ether bodies, while the ego and the astral body within are under the influence of the stored-up moon forces. We therefore bear, while we are awake and the action of the sun irradiates from without our physical and ether bodies, we bear inwardly during the waking state stored-up moon influences. In the human ego and astral body, the sun lives during the state of sleep and the moon during the state of waking. In the physical and ether bodies, the sun lives during the waking state and the moon during sleep. And since this is so, even though the person is a night reveler and instead of sleeping prepares himself during the night for the headache of the following morning, these influences are nevertheless present in the same manner. For even though the external interrelationships are not observed, these things are of such a nature that they run their course nonetheless for the human being, by reason of their own inertia, by reason of a capacity for persistence which is in the cosmos itself. Even though a person sleeps by day and remains awake by night, yet while he is awake by night, he bears in his ego and his astral body the moon influences, and the sun influences come in contact with him only through the fact that they meet him in the form of street lamps, or, if he is lying somewhere in the fields, in the form of feeble starlight and the like. But it is always the sun influences that the human being conserves in sleep, the moon influences that the human being bears inwardly in himself while awake. And the reverse is true in regard to the physical and ether bodies, as regards the external part of man. It is to this interrelationship that the human being owes his customary consciousness between birth and death. We shall now see how the ascent to other forms of consciousness changes these things. For in the case of initiates, the relationship to the sun and moon is somewhat altered, more and more altered, and this change of relationship to the cosmos constitutes the way into the spiritual world. I do not need to describe how a man stands within the world in the presence of the sun and moon through the ordinary consciousness. This may be brought before the soul of anyone who bethinks himself as to how the day appears, how one lives as a man by day, how one lives as a man by night. The moment that a person begins to strengthen the inner forces of his soul for the otherwise chaotic dream consciousness, the moment that he brings it about that the otherwise dreaming consciousness becomes an instrument for the perception of reality, that very moment he becomes aware that during the waking state, stored-up moon is present in his ego. In the moment when anyone really transmutes the dream into reality by means of initiation knowledge, he feels as if he were pervaded by a second man. But he knows that in this second man there lives the force of the moon sphere. At the beginning, then, of initiate consciousness, one goes about saying to oneself, quote, "The force of the moon sphere lives within me, and it really always has the tendency to build up within me a second man, whom I then bear within my first man as in a sheath." Unquote. And now also the struggle has already begun. It is not during the day consciousness, during the waking consciousness, but during sleep consciousness that the moon begins inwardly to work in the person, in this second man that I have just said is normally released in the human being through the inner influences of the moon. If he is released by the actual moon during the night, if this second man then asserts himself during the dull state of sleep, then this second man, who is concealed within the first man, who is concealed in the ordinary man, will wander about in the moonlight, and he takes the first man with him. Thus arises that somnambulistic state which we see manifesting itself in the case of these moonlight rovers. Picture to yourself now that when the moon shines externally, the second man may awake, who then forces his way into strange magical, that is, more than ordinary, action, deviating from action that is natural. The man wanders around. Picture to yourself this night rover. In a suppressed state of consciousness, the person does all sorts of things that he would not do during ordinary consciousness. During ordinary consciousness, he would remain lying at rest on his bed. That is his place. Instead of this, he roves around outside, climbs up on the roofs of houses. He is seeking for that sphere which ought really to be outside his physical body. Observe now that if this is translated into the normal, if it is brought to a conscious inner experience, it is the condition at the beginning of initiate consciousness. Only one does not then approach the moon influence, the influence of the real moon, from without, but one causes the moon influence born inwardly to build up the consciousness of the second man. We must now concentrate all our forces in order to prevent this second man from going away from us. With the first man we should like to remain at rest, but this second man might go away, wander astray as something insubstantial, enter upon entirely false paths. We must restrain him. It is this that absolutely must occur in connection with the acquisition of initiate consciousness, inner firmness and control, in order that what wills to go outward shall remain within one, and shall be held bound by the entirely customary, matter-of-fact consciousness that we have in our physical body. But it is necessary that we struggle continually in order that this second man who has been formed within by the strengthened inner moon being shall not go away from us. The second inner man who has been formed there is very strongly drawn to everything consisting in the metabolic influences, influences of movement within man, to everything that proceeds from the stomach and other organs. To all this he is extremely strongly drawn. He takes an extremely strong hold upon these forces. It is this, you observe, with which we are concerned, this which becomes primarily an experience for the beginning initiate consciousness, that this consciousness shall go by one of the two paths that must be traversed, the one through giving form to the dream world, through the realizing, the actualizing of the dream world. If one now reflects, and one must reflect, as I have explained to you, then one comes to this thought, that outwardly it is day, yet inwardly one bears the night within one. In the midst of the day, something awakes like an inner night. If this initiate consciousness begins, the day is there, indeed, for the outer eye, for the outer grasp upon things. But within the space of this day, there begins everywhere to weave and to live spiritual moonlight, which radiates round about, shines round about, and the spiritual begins to give forth light. We know, therefore, that we are placing night within the day by means of our own soul. If all this occurs in full consciousness, occurs just as anything else is performed by day by a sane man, if this sane man is able to conjure the nightly influences of the moon into the midst of the influences of day, he is then upon the right path. But if he brings anything whatever into himself without being fully aware that the night passes into the day through his inner forces, he is entering a false path, which leads finally to the mediumistic. The determinative element, therefore, is the full consciousness, inner control of the fact into which one passes vitally, not the phenomenon in itself, not the fact in itself, but the manner in which one enters vitally into this. If the ordinary nightly wanderer by moonlight could develop full clarity of mind at the moment when he is climbing up to the roof, he would be in that moment an initiate. He does not do this. But if you call out and awaken him, he falls. If he did not fall but evolved full consciousness and could remain in it within this condition, he would then be an initiate. The task of initiation knowledge is to develop not only in a sound, but in a more than sound manner, what there evolves in a diseased manner. You see how the true and the false in the spiritual world are side by side, separated only by a hair's breadth. In the physical world it is easy to distinguish the false and the true, since there we have the coarse-meshed sifter of logic, the coarse meshed experience. As soon as we enter into the spiritual world, this distinction is extraordinarily difficult. It depends entirely upon the inner attitude, upon the inner clarity. Furthermore, if a person has thus awakened night during the day, moonlight then gradually loses its character of external illumination. It no longer appears so external. It simply produces a general feeling of life. But something else comes about. In this sky of the spiritual night, there now gleams in wonderful glimmering light Mercury. The star Mercury really rises in this night, conjured into the day. Not, however, as we see Mercury through the telescope, but we are aware that this is something living. It is not easy to distinguish the living spiritual beings that inhabit Mercury, but we are in general aware, through the manner and fashion in which Mercury acts, that we have to do with the spiritual world. If the moonlight becomes to us, in the spirit, a general elixir of life, within which we feel ourselves to be the spiritual star Mercury then gradually rises in this night, conjured into the day. Out of this sparkling twilight and shadowy sparkling in which Mercury meets one, there steps forth that being who is then designated as the divine being Mercury. We need him. We need him absolutely, otherwise confusion arises. We must primarily find in the spiritual world this being of whom we know quite well that he belongs to the Mercury beings. Through learning to know him, we can then control by our will, the second man who has been brought to life within us. We do not any longer need to give ourselves up like the moonlight wanderer to uncertain ways, but we can take definite paths into the spiritual world by the side of this divine messenger, Mercury. The important matter, then, is that if we wish to find the right ways into the spiritual world, we must first pass through very definite experiences, which afford us guidance and direction. The ordinary mystic submerges himself in his own inner being. There arises a medley of feeling in which everything is promiscuously mingled, God and world and angel and devil. The ordinary mystic really mingles all these together. The most that one can arrive at is a general sort of dreams, concerning which it is not possible to distinguish whether they come from the sexual sphere or the head sphere. In general, they are in an indiscriminate muddle, the experiences mixed together in a complete medley. This is the unclarified nebulous mysticism, which does not illuminate the dream, which on the contrary permeates the dream with a greater chaos, which is then intelligible only to the initiate. Such experiences, as they are described, like those of Catherine of Siena and similar persons, which are so wonderful, so sublimely poetic, these can be understood only by an initiate, for he alone knows what is really in process there. It may therefore be said, quote, if you practice your initiate state in full consciousness, just as clear and transparent as consciousness is when you calculate or work with geometry, if you enter into these things with this absolutely complete knowledge, you then find the right way. Unquote. Only when a person knows, quote, thou art conjuring the inner night into the outer day, thou findest the real and actual spiritual world, unquote, in such a manner that no one can deny the moon is rising, that Mercury is rising in external space worlds, that this is not dreamt but real. This is found only when a person enters therein with full consciousness and meets spiritual beings, just as we may meet men in the physical world. And false ways will be trod, such as are to be found wherever men desire to seek in spirit, without being conscious of something which is there in the spiritual world. When a person simply remains upon the earth and experiments with mediums, without really entering into the spiritual world, but will experiment only with what the medium produces externally and does not really encounter the spiritual, he is then on a false path. Everything that does not awaken consciousness in the spiritual world, but wanders farther afield in sleep and will only study effects, as in the case of external occultism, is on a false way. Whatever, when it enters the spiritual world, encounters the spiritual world as a reality, but one that is spiritual, is on the right path. So you see, the inner, vital, knowing perception of the moon's sphere is the point of departure for the way of initiation. And we may say that what otherwise, during the waking state, when the human moon is working inwardly, what otherwise during the waking state appears only in relationship to the sun and moon, this appears now, in the case of the initiate, during the waking state as it otherwise did only in sleep. The person becomes aware of the moon influences as if they were external. He conjures the night into the day. And instead of the entire heaven, equally glittering with stars for the ordinary observation by night, the star Mercury rises spiritually. If then one has, in the manner I have described, in knowledge of the higher worlds and its attainment, if one has reached the point of shaping imaginations, of attaining to real imaginations, the world of imaginations then meets one as a reality, just here, in this moon world, during the day. But when we enter into the Mercury influences, these imaginations then pass over to their beings. One does not now set forth mere visions, behind which there is nothing real, but one now sets forth visions as imaginations. These, however, pass over to their corresponding beings. If, therefore, you have not yet progressed far enough on your way of initiation, you may have the vision of an archangelos or an archangel, but it remains a vision. Only when you have penetrated further does this vision really pass over to the archangel, and you then see the vision of the archangel, who remains within it. Hitherto, in mere moonlight, he did not need to remain within it. Now he is concealed within it. Thus do you become aware of the Mercury influences, in that your visionary world flows over into a true perceptual world of the spiritual. All this, we must mention again and again, can be reached in the right manner only in a state of complete clarity of mind. When the person practices his meditation still further empowers his inner being, renders it more and more active, he then attains to the Venus influence in addition to the Mercury influence. And behold, when the Venus influence appears, when Venus rises in this night, conjured into the day, then the visions lose themselves in the presence of the beings who have there arisen, who appear in the forms of imagination, of real visions. The visions then lose themselves in these. One then stands with empty consciousness in the presence of the spiritual world. One knows that the spiritual beings are there. One has arrived at the sphere of Venus. The spiritual beings are there. One waits until the sun sphere meets one. All of this is a preparation for experiencing now a second time the sun. We do all of this, indeed, during the waking life of day, when we are under the sun influences from without. We stand thus during the whole day in the sun influences from without. We traverse this way that I have described through moon, Mercury, Venus. The visions then lose themselves. We penetrate further. The whole way was a way from earth to moon, to Mercury, to Venus, to sun. We enter the inner being of the sun. We see the sun the second time, spiritually. It does not remain. It is vague, but we know that we are perceiving it spiritually. We look into the inner being of the sun. If I may use a very crude comparison, it is as if one should say to oneself, quote, I see something there in the distance. I draw near to it, supposing it at first to be something artificially made. I draw near to it, take hold of it, and it seizes my hand in its teeth. Now I know that it is not artificially made, that it is a real dog. Unquote. I become aware that this was, quote, an inner, unquote. This crude comparison may call your attention to the fact that this is something. One passes from the earth through the moon influences, the Mercury influences, the Venus influences, and reaches a point where the sun is perceived in such a way that one observes that it is a living spiritual being, and beings also live within it. This is the way, first of all, that can be developed, and it shows conclusively with every step one takes upon it how the initiate must, as he advances, preserve his complete clarity of mind, that he will then journey upon the right path. And now a person who is not aware that whenever he passes out of himself in any matter whatever, he enters into the cosmos, and that the cosmos becomes spiritual before his spiritual vision, how this person is going upon a false road. You see, we must know inwardly the distinction between true and false paths in the spiritual vision. Now I pointed out to you yesterday how because of a certain necessity of the times, psychic occult societies of the most various kinds, employing methods which are an imitative caricature of those of the natural sciences, seek to investigate the spiritual world in connection with external phenomena. Do not misunderstand me. I do not wish to appear as a critic of these methods, for I know only too well how deep may be the longing to enter into the nature of the spiritual world by observing external facts in the scientific ways. I wish only to show how these ways must lead to error, and how, on the contrary, we must hold to the true ways. It is entirely intelligible today, since we live in a natural scientific epoch, and must continue so to live, that men should come forward who wish to investigate the spiritual world just as we investigate in natural science, men who consider purely spiritual ways uncertain. They therefore come to the point where they say, quote, on the one side there lies the sphere of the normal world. There men move about who are carrying out their purposes, imposed upon them by external social life. There men move about who think and work in accordance with this external social life. Since we are accustomed to this, there is nothing more in it of a special character. In this field, natural science pursues its researches, concerning itself with external phenomena, with the phenomena of warmth, light, electricity, magnetism. But there appear in life also abnormal facts. Men comport themselves as automatic writers, as persons who perform this or that thing to which they have been induced during an hypnosis, by suggestion, etc., one has the feeling that an unknown world is thus speaking within the ordinary world. These external signs that are then received, these abnormal facts, one desires to interpret. End quote. One wishes to explain how it comes about that when someone in New York thinks and experiences something physically, a person living in Europe in soul communion with this one receives the news from him inwardly, knows it as we ordinarily receive news in an external fashion only by wireless telegraphy. Such phenomena, which might be related by hundreds and thousands, are investigated in a statistical, external, scientific manner. This path cannot lead to a goal, for the reason that one does not here take a spiritual direction, such as one ought to travel in, but which must lie within the spiritual world itself. Excuse me, let me read that again. This path cannot lead to a goal, for the reason that one does not here take a spiritual direction, such as one ought to travel in, but which must lie within the spiritual world itself. All these phenomena, however, wonderful they may be, then lie as an aggregation in the external world, one on top of the other, one by the side of the other. We do not by any means attain to knowledge, to understanding, but can only register these things as something wonderful that has been seen, to think out hypotheses in regard to the spiritual world, which have no significance, however, because these phenomena simply do not really tell us what they are in this external world into which they have been set from a spiritual world. They do not really express what they are. No matter how much we have to do with mediums, with external natural scientific facts, although the spiritual world reveals itself in these, yet it does not express itself in its real nature. Then occurs, you see, that investigation of which I said to you yesterday, that the effort is being made by Dr. Wegmann, together with me, to set forth this also exactly. This investigation proceeds just as little as the other investigation I have explained to you that seeks to illuminate the inner dream world. This proceeds just as little in such a way as to avoid the spiritual world, parenthesis, as this inner dream world can never avoid entrance into the spiritual world, parenthesis, but it proceeds in such a way that it takes the phenomena afforded for such investigation in direct relation with the goals that are opened in the spiritual world for such research. But these phenomena do not consist in the widespread wonderful facts that we meet in the external world in the manner described. These phenomena lie in the realms visible to the person thoroughly trained in medicine, anatomy, and physiology, when from his conception of the external form of a human organ, the lungs or the liver or any other human organ, he ascends to an imaginative conception of this organ, which enables him gradually to place the human organization in imaginations before his soul. You see, this is possible, then, if one is able to study these organs, that in a normal condition do not act like external natural phenomena, but in a normal state act like the abnormal phenomena. That is, when one can take as a point of departure scientific anatomical knowledge within the man, which then ascends to a spiritual perception of the human organization. In the method that I have already described, one proceeds from the whole man. It is from individual human organs, grasped and directly conceived through a spiritual anatomy, that one proceeds by that path which can lead to the right end, in contrast with the erroneous method which lays hold upon external phenomena in a manner caricaturing statistics and natural science. You can understand, therefore, that it was necessary first to find a person who had a place in this manner quite regularly in the field of medicine, in order to be able to explain these things. Now, to continue further, the important matter is that at the moment when a person views a human organ in this manner spiritually, when there is a person who views anatomy in this fashion, this goal shall not then live in his thoughts as an intermediate goal, as an indeterminate goal. In this case, it is not an inner man who arises, as I have previously described, but there arises an external man, a cosmic man, who still appears nebulous, to be sure, but as a cosmic man, as a great gigantic man, the human being viewed not as an earthly totality, but viewed by beholding his organs, inwardly and spiritually comprehending them. Since these organs are now manifest in the spirit, it is no longer merely the earthly man who stands there, but the man who encompasses the cosmos. Just as we have previously conjured the night world, the moon world, into the day world, so now we conjure the impulses of the spheres of Saturn into the human being, into what is no longer the whole man, the man within his contours, but the man consisting of his individual organs. Just as the moon sphere was previously conjured into the ordinary daylight consciousness, so now the sphere of Saturn is conjured into the scientific consciousness, and we become aware that the forces of Saturn work in every organ in a special way. That the forces of Saturn work, for example, in the liver most intensely, in the lungs comparatively little, in the head least of all. We then become aware of the goal that we learn to express as follows. Quote, "You have to seek everywhere for Saturn," unquote. And just as we have pressed forward previously by means of meditation, so we press forward now by giving ourselves vitally to this search for Saturn, for the spirit blended inwardly in every organ. Thus one now penetrates into the Jupiter sphere and learns to know that every organ is really the earthly copy of a divine spiritual being. The human being bears inwardly in his organs the copies of divine spiritual beings. The entire cosmos, which first became a great man in the Saturn sphere, the entire human being becomes clear to us as a gigantic cosmic being. But in the sense that he appears as the summation, the inward organic co-working of generations of gods. Once more, it is necessary that this path should be trod in complete clarity of mind. It must be so traversed that on this path those forces shall work which may maintain all this. You must reflect that all of this consists in influences which at first live as in a status nascendi, which are there, but even while they are there, immediately disappear again. It is easy, indeed, for this reason to grasp them, but it is impossible to describe them, to hold them fast, to mold them in any manner whatever in the forms of thought or of pictures, if we succumb to the peril that exists here, namely, that while all that I have described to you comes forth, and all likewise immediately disappears from consciousness, we should not succeed at all in viewing it. You see, the modern men, given to psychical research, do not at all think of calling really upon the spiritual. They want to carry out all these things in laboratory fashion, in an easy-going way, by introducing A, B, C as human beings into the laboratory, and evoking these things from them. Spiritual realities do not permit themselves to be brought in this manner into the world that is attainable by human knowledge. Least of all those realities that must be grasped in this manner and must be described gradually in a really scientific fashion. What I said yesterday in regard to that book could represent only the first, most elementary beginning, and it will be long after we are no longer alive that this will become a developed science. But just as truly as these things are present today in the spiritual world, just as truly as they are mere commonplaces, for example, among the beings that are no longer on earth but live in the sun, just so truly can they be brought down into the earthly consciousness in the manner described. Only it must not be supposed that it is possible to conduct researches like those in laboratories, and it must likewise not be supposed that we can, by means of abstract anatomy and the like, as these things are found in textbooks, make further progress in this sphere. The important thing here is that all this shall pass through the living man. Why? Because these things can be firmly held only when we lay hold of them with those forces which come into existence through the united endeavors of men, when they are seized, so to speak, by means of those forces that men bear within them out of their previous earth lives. And when these forces more than aught else are employed for holding firmly these things. For when this happens, then there enters into that world of the Saturn and the Jupiter sphere what is known as the Mars sphere. From that time on, things begin to speak. From that time on, things begin to reveal themselves through inspiration. Then we come again to the Sun with the inspired consciousness. This is the other way which proves to be in our day that which is demanded by natural science, which those initiates of whom I spoke yesterday prefer to avoid. It is unpleasant to them when they enter upon this way, which must, however, be travelled. For the way through the moon sphere, this will be clear to you also by reason of the explanations given today, has indeed been travelled in wonderful fashion by the ancient initiates, and we have indeed wonderful things, especially in the secret doctrine of Blavatsky, in regard to this moon way. Only it is necessary to be able to distinguish the right from the wrong. But when we have done this, there are impressive truths in this secret doctrine. But it is the way which passes through the moon's astral light in which Helena Petrovna Blavatsky could live in wonderful fashion, and in which the messenger Mercury became a wonderful guide to her for her interpretations. We can see this when we follow her explanations, how she always conducts the imaginations to the right places. It is indeed wonderful in the case of Blavatsky. Whenever she develops an idea, the imagination is there. The messenger, Mercury, guides her. He guides her where there is a buried library. The idea arises in her. The messenger, Mercury, guides her to a book carefully preserved by the Vatican. Blavatsky reads in this, and much is to be found in Blavatsky which she would not have been able otherwise to find, because the Vatican carefully preserved it, because it has been carefully preserved for hundreds of years. This is really the way that has been very much travelled, in regard to which it is necessary to distinguish carefully among all those things those that have been made in a state of firm inner self-control, as I have pointed out. And the other way follows that track which I have described, which reckons with the ways of modern natural science, and which Helena Petrovna Blavatsky hated like the night. That is, she hated the night. But the ordinary man fears ghosts. This is the way that must be travelled in the manner I have made known, which must become conscious that in the karmic evolution of forces in the human being, it finds the supports, the strength, not so much for the purpose of attaining to memories, but in order to hold them firmly, so that they may be described. The end of Lecture 10.